supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, if you're a pet owner, I'm sure you're familiar with this scenario. You come home from work, you're stressed, angry, unhappy, and your dog greets you at the door, wagging his tail, thrilled to see you, or your cat jumps on your lap. Suddenly, somehow, the stress diminishes. Same thing happens with your kids. Well, we've long known about the special bond between humans and animals. It's been going on for thousands of years, and we've noticed how animals positively influence our mental health and well-being, but we're only recently beginning to understand why that is. Over the last decade, scientists have started to investigate our interactions with animals, and their findings are really astounding. We'll hear more about this research on today's show. Our guests are Froma Walsh and Meg Olmert. Froma Walsh is co-director of the Chicago Center for Family Health. She's the Mose and Sylvia Feinstein Professor at the University of Chicago. And she's written two articles about the human-animal bond, both published in Family Process. Froma, welcome to the show.
I'm very happy to be here.
Meg Olbert has developed and produced many documentaries about dogs. She's the author of Made for Each Other, The Biology of the Human-Animal Bond. Meg, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Later on, we're going to be hearing from Gloria Gilbert Stoga. She's the founder of Puppies Behind Bars. We'll hear about the healing work animals can do with prisoners and veterans. And we'd like to hear your stories about animals. Our number is 888-477-9499. Tell us what your animal means to you and how your animal has changed you. So let's start with you, Froma. Your entry into the field's an interesting one. It started when you began practicing family therapy. What happened?
Well, actually, it started in childhood. Both my mother and father worked, and I was an only child. Since my mother was a piano teacher, it meant she was away after school. So I would come home to my dog, Rusty. And Rusty really was my primary companion, caretaker, giver of affection. We would share milk and cookies as I studied. So I've had a lifelong personal understanding of how valuable that bond could be. When I was actually getting my doctorate, I was taking a course with a professor on communication patterns in couples' relationships, and he set up a video camera with just an ordinary university couple over dinner every night in the week, and was very surprised when we looked at those videos that each time in the dinner conversation that there was tension between the two of them, the cat would come in from the kitchen, jump up on her lap. She would start stroking the cat. The two would smile at each other, she and her husband, and the tension would subside.
Well, Froma, we family therapists know that's what kids do.
Exactly.
When there's tension between parents, somehow the kids cut the tension out, either by acting out or intervening or something. So speaking of how animals fit in families and how kids fit in families, we tend to treat our animals like we do our children. Some are disciplined and obedient, while others seem to rule the family.
Well, and there can also be conflict between partners. Young couples these days often decide they're going to maybe raise a dog or some cats before they try raising children. And often the disputes will come up over whether that pet can be on the sofa or in the bed, or whether one is too lenient or one is too strict. So many of the same kinds of disputes can arise around raising pets as around raising children.
Yeah, and pets don't help resolve that one, huh?
They can often play partners off by, just as children will do, going to the one that they know is the soft touch.
Yeah.
I'm the soft touch, obviously.
Yeah, I guessed that. That was not a stretch. I've worked many years in my practice with a dog. And, you know, it's been two dogs over the years. And sometimes what they do is uncanny. And I don't know if they're extraordinarily perceptive or if I'm attributing human characteristics to them. For example, my late dog, Loki, who just died in January, when a patient's story became repetitive or monotone, Loki would either sigh loudly or just walk out of the room. I mean, and either way, it was an amazing intervention. I mean, the patient would often look at me and say, "Was I being boring?" And I'd say, well.
No, that's definitely quite a common story that I hear from therapists. In our training as therapists in the mental health field, pets have sort of not come in to mainstream mental health therapies. And yet, when I talk to therapists, it's quite common. And increasingly, we're starting to get certification for dogs or other animals to be therapy dogs or to be therapy animals, because particularly with dogs, they do have extraordinary sense of awareness of nonverbal communication, of picking up feeling tones and atmosphere, so that they will, if someone is upset or crying, they'll come over and put their nose on the person's lap,
and it's been
and offer. You can pet me, and you will feel better. One story a colleague of mine told of a man for the first time in his life telling his therapist about sexual abuse he had suffered as a child. And after he told his story, the therapist said, "I'm so glad you felt comfortable opening up to me." And he said, "Oh, I wasn't telling you. I was telling Jake, your dog, who I'm sitting here petting."
And I have to tell you, Froma, many of my patients were really mourning when Loki passed away.
Yes. And that's something that in our society often gets minimized or trivialized. Some people are insensitive to the strength of the attachment with animals. And they might say, "Oh, it's only an animal," or "You can get another dog," really underestimating that attachment.
Meg, I want to go back over some history. Stories I read about how this relationship with animals begin. The stories I read usually starts with domestic wolves some 14,000 years ago living in near the same settlements as humans. They needed our food, and we needed their protection. How did that evolve, Meg?
Well, it may even be a lot earlier than that, they're finding now. But I just want to say that that was me laughing really hard at the boring alert story about your dog in therapy. That's enough for me to go out and get two dogs if it tells people to stop being boring. But these are all just so stories, as they say in archaeology, because behavior doesn't leave a hard fossil evidence behind. But what it does tell us is this, that we went from being prey animals. We were smaller, slower, weaker, far, far, far fewer. I mean, the latest study showed that there might have been only 55,000 humans on the whole planet during the early Ice Age. And here we were surrounded by all these giant animals that were far better adapted. They were deadly predators, and we were in that ecological niche now. Well, as we became better at hunting, we had garbage, and this is the theory, was that we ate certain bits and threw the best bits away because we had maybe evolved eating marrow and brains, because that was what we were scavenging and all that was left to us from the kill of the big predators. And the wolf was the top predator of the Ice Age. They were everywhere. And they weren't the wolves that we have today. I think we can clearly say that. The wolves we have today are not the survivors of a Holocaust. They are living in the middle of an ongoing Holocaust. So the wolves that we have today are the ones who have the most fight-flight reactive systems. They are the most paranoid. There's no reason to think that wolves were that frightened of us at all when we were no threat whatsoever.
So what happened back there that relationship evolved into a friendly one?
Well, it's really common in nature for feeding symbiotic relationships to grow up around getting food with one another between species. And so if wolves started hanging around our garbage piles and all of a sudden this new ecological niche opened up for them, it was probably the tamest, the most gregarious of the wolves that would have wanted to do that to begin with, or would have been tolerant of that kind of stress to be around another species. And if we started in any way keeping their pups, now bear in mind that women, primitive women all over the world always have and still do suckle young animals. Hmm. We now know that when a woman suckles anything, there's a huge release of oxytocin in both the baby and the woman. So there's a very, very, very strong possibility that as we took in wolf pups from these particular wolf populations that were perhaps the least startle reactive, the most friendly, tamest, we take in their pups, we start literally suckling them and caring for them. Huge bonds could have grown quite easily because it would have triggered the chemistry that we now know triggers social bonding, triggers the mother-infant bond, and all kinds of social bonding.
So what we're learning is that when we describe ourselves as social animals, that goes cross-species.
We are mammals. We are social mammals, and we have the same brain chemistry that supports those emotions and behaviors as animals do.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to go to the phones. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about our relationship with our animals. Give us a call. Tell us about your relationship with your animal, living or deceased, and how the animal has changed you. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Let's go to the phones. We've got Matt on the line. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how you doing, Dan?
Good, thanks. What can we do for you?
I wanted to tell you about my dog. I had a service dog for 10 years, and we got to a point where we didn't even use words anymore. We would just look at each other, and from our body language, you know, we knew what was going on. And when I would go down steps, he would stand in front of me, and in case I fell, he would stop me. And if there were steps that I thought I could do, but I couldn't, and he would look at me, and I would, based on his judgment, and we would find another way around. And he saved my life twice. He risked his life to save me. And so, you know, we had such a great and strong bond. And
Matt, I can only guess about how you felt about this dog. I wonder if you can say how this dog changed you.
He would, because of him, I could go out and do things that I otherwise wouldn't have been able to do. And there were things that I had to build up strength, like getting up curbs, and he would pull me up a curb. But after a while, you know, he would kind of look at me and say, you know, you can do this. And so by the time that he died, I was much more capable than I was when we started out together.
That's amazing. He wasn't a companion dog. He was like a physical therapist, cheerleader to you.
And in many ways, he was. And he also helped with other people. You know, they would come up, and it wouldn't be about the fact that I didn't have arms. It would be that I had this great dog. And he really helped me to become more social and kind of come out of my shell.
When did he die?
He died in 2002.
Hmm. Do you have another companion dog?
No, I haven't been able to. I've tried, but I just haven't been able to have a relationship like the one that I had with Rocky.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like there's still some mourning in there.
Can I maybe comment there?
Sure. Give me your name, because your voices sound similar.
Oh, Froma Walsh.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that this is very common, that people experience grief and as strongly as another, as a human relationship, particularly if the bond has been as powerful and life-sustaining for you over so many years. Over 85% of persons report grief symptoms when a pet dies, and over one-third have continuing grief at 6 months. And it can be much longer in a case where you have a partnership with a service animal.
Hmm.
And to that, I would add that since it's supported, this bond and the emotions that you felt for your dog were supported by the same biochemistry that supports the mother-infant bond, which is the strongest bond we can make. You're not imagining that you felt those incredibly powerful emotions and sense of attachment. And so naturally, there is a huge grieving thing. And the cardiovascular benefits that you get from being around a pet,
your heart rate
comes down. Literally, your heart was broken when you lost that animal.
Let me back you up, Meg. You said something. You said it's the same biochemistry that is involved with the mother-infant bond. What do you mean? What is that biochemistry exactly?
It's centered around the hormone oxytocin. Oxytocin, we knew, released breast milk and labor contractions, but about 20 years ago they started noticing it was made in every part of the brain that controls behavior and emotion. And when they started doing studies in lab animals and then up through humans, they found that it is the critical component of creating the sense of attraction and attachment between mother and infant, and also all powerful social bonds in general. So it's, all animals, all mammals make it, and it works pretty much the same way in all social animals, and so that's what happens between us and our pets. We aren't imagining that these are family members. I mean, I'm sure Froma will tell you that the studies that show that most people consider their pet a significant part of their family.
Right.
It can be their only friend, and far more important.
Yeah,
family.
We're going to have to take a break now. When we come back, we've got lots and lots of callers, and I do want to address some of the research about what these animals do know about us and what they know about the world around themselves. Our number is 888-477-9499. If the line's busy, please be patient. We'll do our best to get to you. My guests are Froma Walsh and Meg Olmert. Walsh is co-director of the Chicago Center for Family Health. She's also a professor emerita at the University of Chicago. She's written two wonderful articles about the human-animal bond, both published in Family Process. Meg Olbert's developed and produced many documentaries about dogs. Her book is called Made for Each Other, The Biology of the Human-Animal Bond. And soon we'll hear from Gloria Gilbert Stoga, who's founder of Puppies Behind Bars. It's an incredible story she has to tell. Well, we'll be back in just 60 seconds. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Unlike most cancers, thyroid cancer affects a younger demographic. Nearly 2 out of 3 cases are found in people between 20 and 55 years of age. And thyroid cancers occur in women nearly 3 times as often as in men. Fox Chase doctors detect thyroid cancer using diagnostic techniques that result in personalized treatment plans for patients. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, perfecting the science of compassionate cancer care.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join me on Tuesday, April 27th at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. We'll explore Einstein's God and the fascinating interplay of questions, if not answers, that is emerging between 21st century science, medicine, theology, and philosophy. Call 215-893-1999 or visit whyy.org/member experience to get your tickets for this evening of ideas on April 27th. I'd love to see you there.
A dog doesn't care if you're rich or poor. Give him your heart, and he'll give you his.
That was from Marley and Me, a book and a movie most of us saw and loved. We're talking about the human-animal bond today. My guests are Meg Olmert, who's written Made for Each Other, The Biology of the Human-Animal Bond, and Froma Walsh, family therapist, who's written two articles about the human-animal bond, both published in Family Process. I want to ask you, Froma, about this love business. It's a pretty complicated emotion. You know, it looks and feels like our animals love us unconditionally, but is it really love? I mean, are they capable of that kind of complex emotion? Do they?
Absolutely. There's growing research now that primates and dogs in particular do have complex feelings. They're sentient beings. Earlier psychologists thought not, that they were really a lower species, and really our emotions were misplaced if we talked about strong feelings. But they can be very important in our lives, and I think, as your caller Matt mentioned, very important in resilience. And I wonder if I could say just a couple things about that. There was a study done of families who had adopted children. And in all 20 families, they had also consciously adopted pets for their children. And what they said was that this the children's bond with the animals had that additional aspect to it, that they were all rescued. And one mother said, in fact, when our cat had kittens, we let our little girl watch their birth and then go around the neighborhood and interview families who would then adopt the kittens. And this gave her a sense of how she was choosing a family who really would love those little kittens, just as her family chose her and loved her.
Well, speaking of rescuing, and the animal and the dog feeling rescued, let's hear from Gloria Gilbert Stoga. Like I said, she's president and founder of Puppies Behind Bars. It's an organization that has inmates train Labrador Retriever puppies to become bomb-sniffing or psychiatric service dogs. The organization has been around since 1997 and has trained over 600 dogs. It operates in 6 prisons throughout New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Inmates have to apply to the program, and if accepted, they actually live with and raise the puppy right in their own cell. Let's listen.
We walk into prison with an 8-week-old puppy in our arms and give the puppy to an inmate who has been in training with Puppies Behind Bars for at least 8 months, and that person then gets this puppy and is fully responsible for all of the dog's training, all of its care, its basic medical care, its grooming, its socialization for the next year to 2 years, depending upon whether it's a bomb-sniffing dog or a service dog in training. Inmate after inmate tells me that in order to survive in prison, you put up emotional walls. You don't trust people. You don't expose yourself. You also don't really show emotion, and you can't be outside with a dog that's running, jumping, going into a pool, coming out, doing a backflip, playing with its buddy dog friend without laughing. an inmate in prison feeling those emotions is really rare. So the feeling of the emotion, the worrying of the dog, the caring of the dog, if the doggie is sick and has an upset stomach, the inmates are besides themselves with concern. All of that makes them human again. It makes them feel emotions that we feel on a daily basis. In 2006, Puppies Van Bar started a program called Dog Tags, Service Dogs for Those Who've Served Us. And we, since then, have been training service dogs specifically for wounded soldiers coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. We specialize in psychiatric service dogs, so those are dogs that go to soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. We train them in 87 different commands. We train them in all of the basic service dog commands, meaning that they can do all sorts of retrieval, they can tug open doors, they can turn on and off lights, they can do the laundry, they can open the refrigerator and get a water bottle or something out and bring it to your lap. Those are basic service dog commands. We train them in all of those, but then we also train them in commands that specifically work with someone who has a psychological injury. When the dogs are about 20, 22 months old, we see if they are ready to be paired with a soldier, and we have pre-screened soldiers and accepted some. And we then put soldier and dog together, and Puppies Behind Bars instructors train the soldiers with the dogs for 2 weeks. During that time, we're training the soldier how to work with the dog, and we're fine-tuning how the dog works with that soldier. We have developed 5 commands specifically for soldiers with PTSD and TBI, and a number of these commands came as feedback from soldiers, what they needed and wanted in their dogs. One command is called Pop a Corner, and that means that prior to going into a room or a building, if the soldier wants, he will give the dog this command, and the dog looks to the left, the dog looks to the right, and then the dog looks up at the soldier, meaning that the dog has checked out the new room or the new building prior to the soldier entering it. This comes from a hallmark of the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan to a certain extent, is that our guys went to buildings and knocked down doors of houses or and schools and whatever looking for insurgents. So our soldiers come home and there is this residual fear of going into an unknown space because perhaps there is an insurgent lying in wait. So this command has the dog physically looking, it's literally just kind of scanning, but it gives the soldier a sense that, yeah, you know what, he checked it out, it's okay to go in the room. I can't tell you how invaluable that is to our soldiers. It gives them peace of mind. It takes away some of their hypervigilance and their fear. So the dogs give them such a sense of companionship, well-being, security, confidence, all of that, that they can start resuming normal lives.
That was Gloria Gilbert Stoga. She's president and founder of Puppies Behind Bars. Froma, they say it wonderfully in this clip that animals make us human, that the dogs humanize the prisoners, help them define, redefine them, and help them reclaim what it means to be human. But so it's not just the dog that's getting trained, it's the human as well, both with the prisoners and with the vets.
That's right. Well, we also find this with adolescents who have been abused or who haven't had loving bonds in their lives. And those that are incarcerated, it may be the first bond that they feel not only as non-judgmental, but it's safe and secure, that a dog that is well cared for is going to be loyal, is going to be trustworthy, is going to be affectionate, and return love to them in a very safe way.
Yeah, one of my mantras at lectures is the best way to get love is to give love.
That's right.
Meg, when did you begin to realize that there was a biological connection between humans and animals?
Well, I've been studying it for 17 years now,
I started as a television producer producing natural history documentaries and seeing people who had extraordinary ways with animals, and then starting to hear these stories that you've been talking about of people having animals having an extraordinary way with people. And this was a long time ago, but still there was enough evidence that I decided instead of telling another one of those stories, I was going to get to the bottom of why it was happening. Mm. And right at that time, you know, because I was hearing stories about heart rate coming down, blood pressure mm-hmm. coming down when people were with animals, and I said, that's a biological change.
So
what is causing that?
Meg, ultimately you wound up at an institution that's local here and friends of ours, Devereaux.
You know, Devereaux was absolutely groundbreaking. They created a pet zoo program at one of their residential treatment facilities for kids who were residential. They were no longer allowed in society. They had such severe ADHD and behavior disorders. They had sort of burned all bridges, and they were in this residential treatment facility. And they started a volunteer program there of pairing children with small animals. It was, like I said, it was voluntary, and they could adopt the animals, and they expected to have they expected success, but they had no idea. They never had a violent outbreak in the zoo, and these same children, it wasn't that they were culling for children who were the best of the bunch. These same children would have to be restrained and given medication when they were in other parts of the campus sometimes, but they never had a problem in the zoo. And those children were able to, even with ADHD and behavior disorder, severe ADHD and behavior disorder, they could listen, they were loving, they attached. It was like your prisoners, Gloria. These children had probably terrible relationships with people for one reason or another, and the animals just brought out the best in them. And I saw them, they would give demonstrations, and the children would stand up and explain who their animals. They would have this, like, giant iguana, and they would explain the natural history of the iguana, where it lived, how I cared for it.
Well, let me turn to Froma. And, mm-hmm. I mean, clearly, you know, there's something biological going on, as Meg refers to.
Yes.
But what's happening psychologically with these kids?
Well, if you think about, you mean for children who haven't been loved or who have been abused, it opens up, it really opens them in a way that they can trust that the feelings that are drawn out by the animal are going to be safe, and they can then begin to trust human beings again.
Yeah, it is about trust.
It raises trust. It makes people more trusting and more trustworthy, and it shuts down the fear center of the brain.
That's yeah, right. And yeah, it's fascinating. We've got a ton of calls. I want to start to get to our callers. Let's start with Mary Ann.
Hi, Dr. Dan. Thank you.
Hi, Mary Ann. Sure. What can we do for you?
I had a very troubling childhood, and as a young adult in college, I had a full-blown nervous breakdown, shock treatments, the whole bit. And I was a very fearful kind of kid, and I loved horses, but I was terrified of them, so I decided to confront that fear and learn to ride. And it was the best thing I ever did. And my best friend of the past, you know, 45 years, her comment was, "You mean all these years, all it would have taken was a horse?"
Yeah.
And it's true. I now live with two horses, 12 cats, a dog, and I'm the happiest person I know.
Well, wait a minute. Back up a little bit. What happened to you?
I was a kid?
No.
Oh, good.
With the horse.
Oh, my God.
What did the horse do to you, for you?
Everything. The horse listens. The horse, just the way that they rub up against you when you're not feeling well, and if you're crying, and if you're disturbed, they're wonderful. I built a bond with my all-time favorite horse, who now is in heaven. He knew my footsteps, and when I was walking to the barn, he would nicker. It was the most fulfilling and honest relationship of my life up until that point, and it was the one place I could relax. I could be me. I didn't have to worry that
exactly
something was going to happen.
Mm. Exactly.
So
and my big prayer every single night is I always hope that everyone finds their horse.
Ah, that's beautiful.
Oh, thank you for doing what you do,
yeah,
Dr. Van,
in many parts.
Sure, Marianne. Thanks so much for your call. We're going to have to take a short break, and when we do, we will come back to your calls and many other questions I've got for our two guests. We're talking about the human-animal relationship. My guests are Meg Olmert, who's written Made for Each Other, The Biology of the Human-Animal Bond. I'm also joined by Froma Walsh, who's co-director of the Chicago Center for Family Health. She's written two articles entitled Human-Animal Bonds 1 and 2, both published in Family Process. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to the Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Orchestra, under the baton of Chief Conductor Charles Dutoit, celebrates Stravinsky April 8th through 17th at the Kimmel Center with a multimedia Beyond the Score presentation of Rite of Spring and performances of Petrushka. It's a chance to hear the fabulous Philadelphians perform these works live. Tickets and information for the Philadelphia Orchestra available by phone at 215-893-1999 or online at philorg.org. The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY.
Respected physicist Shirley Jackson became the first black woman to earn a PhD from MIT and to lead a top research university. Now she's helping the next generation of American scientists.
We have talent right here, and we have to excite them, we have to prepare them, and we have to celebrate them when they are successful.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the human-animal bond with Froma Walsh and Meg Olmert. Froma Walsh is co-director of the Chicago Center for Family Health and has written two articles on human-animal bonds, both published in Family Process. She's also the Mose and Sylvia Firestone Professor Emerita at the University of Chicago. Meg Olmert has developed and produced many documentaries about dogs. She's written Made for Each Other, The Biology of the Human-Animal Bond. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Beth on the line. Hi, Beth.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Thank you so much for the show, all your shows.
Yeah, thanks. This is great fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
So tell me about your animals.
Well, I have a really large yellow lab. His name is Utah, and he is sweet, gentle, kind, loyal, and loving. Mm-hmm. And during a period of time when my family went through an extremely, extremely difficult and bitter divorce, I have three children, he was really, I think, the foundation of security for them going through it.
Yeah, there's...
Yes. I hear many stories like that, and especially for children going through tumultuous disruptions, to have that family pet that just kind of keeps you stable and is always there,
right.
It can mean,
no matter how much I might have attempted to keep things stable, of course there was a lot of tension and a lot of conflict, and they were ranging in age from about 10 to 15 when they were going through it,
mm-hmm.
And it was pretty prolonged. And, you know, I look at the dog and I think to myself, he was like a Buddha to them in a sense.
Yes.
He was constantly loving, foundational. He didn't engage in any of the negativity, obviously. He was
mm-hmm.
just there to give and receive love and to give and receive security. And I know my children would say to this day that he was an enormous part of helping them feel safe and healing through the process.
Well,
exactly.
Froma, mm-hmm. we know that kids are like sponges for emotions, that
mm-hmm.
any emotion any parent is feeling, whether it gets verbalized or not, the kids
yeah.
are going to pick it up. But dogs don't seem to do that. I mean, they don't absorb, I don't think, agitation or anger.
They can if they're in a household where there is a lot of high conflict. Their tendency is either to go under the bed or into a closet, get as far away, or to come into the middle of it and even try to break it up and to bring about either some distractions. Some might do some kind of silly antics to draw attention away. Some might actually get in between two people that are having difficulty. Actually, I want to comment in situations of violence in families. Often, women who have been abused and are where there's ongoing abuse of them and their children are reluctant to leave the household if their partner threatens to harm or to kill their animal, and it may prevent them from seeking shelter. Shelters are starting to become aware of this because many didn't allow pets to come with them, and women did not want to leave their animals behind.
Hmm. Beth, thanks so much for your call, and thanks so much for your story. Yes, they are like the Buddha. Let's go to Amy, who's been waiting patiently for a while. Hi, Amy, you're on Voices.
Thank you. Dr. Dan, I love your show, and I listen to it religiously on Mondays.
Before
I ask my question, I'd like to give you guys a little bit of background. I had a childhood dog that really took me out of a depression and was a rock for me when my mother went through cancer and I lived on my own in an apartment and my entire family dissolved before my eyes and the only thing I had was this dog. And he recently passed away. And unfortunately, what I've noticed is that I had met someone and we were in a great relationship and he was very into dogs. And he constantly picks them before me. And my question is, how do you handle it when, even though you're a dog lover, some people really value their animals more than people?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I'm going to turn to Froma. And Froma, I want you to be careful with this answer because my daughter is one of those people.
But if you think about couples and children, it would be like coming in to a relationship where a partner is bringing a child from a former relationship, or where there's a sense of competition. Do you love me more than your child? And I think they're at a different level, or it's like sibling rivalry. Who do you love more? I had a couple come in where the husband could sit for hours petting his cat every evening on the sofa, but couldn't show affection to her. And I think it's important that to strengthen the couple bond and to kind of take that pet out of the middle of it.
Well, how, on Amy's behalf, how is that done, Froma?
I think talking with your partner about how... I guess valuing the bond that your partner has with the pet, but being able to speak up about what your needs are in your relationship with him, that he can show you the same kind of consideration, that it isn't like you're in second place.
Yeah, and Amy, I would strongly suggest against criticizing his relationship with the cat or...
Mm-hmm.
Or any of that kind of thing, saying anything that would really threaten or feel threatening to his relationship.
And I also say, too, that it may stir for you how the yearning that you may have for the animal that was so important in your life, who is no longer there for you. And maybe it's time to think about another animal for yourself. A home often can welcome more than one pet, and as we've heard, many homes have several pets.
So it sounds like, Amy, you and your partner have lots to talk about. Thanks so much for listening so often, and thanks so much for calling in. So let's continue with the phone calls. We've got Melissa on the line. Melissa, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi.
What can we do?
We got a puppy shortly after our first baby died, a couple of months later, and we found that she was able to help us laugh our way through our grief. Every day, Olive gave us something to laugh about, and she got us outside and spending time with a fun-loving dog that really helped us through our process.
Well, it really is. You know, I know Meg talks about oxytocin, and I know it's that, but it also, having a dog helps you kind of get out of your head and into right into this moment. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's what dogs demand.
Mm-hmm.
Froma, you agree?
Everything you say, I'm nodding here in agreement. We hear that so often. A widow who says, my cat has been with me through the illness and death of my husband, and now as I'm living alone, and there's no way really to put into words just how that animal can bring joy on a daily basis, bring laughter, bring you into the moment, force you to get out of the house and go out for walks, be out with other people, go to, for instance, especially with dogs, the dog parks, dog beaches, where you meet other people, you form new relationships. So there are so many aspects to the relationship that different parts of it can stand out at different times.
Melissa, thanks so much for your call, and I am sorry about your loss. I just want to notify our listeners that we're going to continue this online after the show, this discussion with Froma and Meg. You can find us online at whyy.org/healthscience, and we'll be up and running at about 1:05. So log in and we'll continue the discussion there. Speaking of grief, you know, pets play an important role, you know, Froma, in child development. But one of the most significant things they do is they teach children about grief, or parents teach children about grief through a pet's death.
That's right. And it's often the death of a pet that is a child's first experience of grief. And so it's important how parents handle it, that they really help the child to be able to talk about the experience of loss and what that pet meant to them. It might be even a hamster or a goldfish. And having maybe a small ritual of burying that hamster in a shoebox in the backyard, where family members can stand around and say what they love most about that pet, what that relationship or that attachment meant in the case of a dog or a cat that has been in your life for a long time. The rituals are very important. It's also important that parents tell the truth. Sometimes parents want to protect children from feeling sad at a loss, and they might say, oh, well, the dog ran off this morning, when actually they had the dog euthanized. And the child may be bewildered, looking around for a long time, waiting for a pet to come back. It's much better to be honest, to be direct, and because, again, this is maybe the first of other losses, and helping that child to normalize the grief experience, to comfort the children with it.
My grandson, Sammy, who's on the autism spectrum, who I've written a couple of books about, and a recent one's just coming out, The Wisdom of Sam. And I wrote about this story in the book. It's when their family pet died, and Sam was, of course, bereft, and it was the first time he saw his parents sobbing.
Mm.
And they all hugged and cried together. And Sam's comment was, at least we're all in this together.
Exactly.
Like, he was grateful that the family could grieve together.
Exactly, sharing that grief. And that's where rituals that are meaningful to the family are a time where they can gather together. When our dog, we had a yellow lab for 14 years, we had the dog euthanized at the end. And that was very hard to do. It was very sad, and yet we were with the dog, we held the dog, we knew the veterinarian, and we asked for the ashes. And we kept the ashes until we went to our summer cottage on Martha's Vineyard, and together we scattered the ashes at the edge of the water at the beach where we return every year. And now we take our dog
Shasta to the same beach, and we watch her running on the beach. And every year we think about Targa, who Shasta didn't replace. She's a new dog. She's a different dog. We had to wait a while before we got another dog. But Targa is always in our memory, in our stories. And every year when we go to the beach, we can imagine her running on the edge of the shore.
It's funny you mentioned about her ashes. I've got Loki's ashes in the house, and I was waiting to bury his ashes to see if it would ever stop snowing here in Philadelphia. and now I'm going to bury it if it ever stops raining here in Philadelphia.
That's nice. And people will plant flowers or a small bush. And as that bush is growing, thinking of how maybe that animal is nurturing the soil of and enabling that plant to grow and bring new life.
I want to, Meg, if in the minute or so we have left, I wonder if there's something about the absence of language that makes the love feel more pure. You know, it's language can often interfere with emotion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the beauty of it is it appeals to the nonverbal portion of our brain. It goes to brainstem. It goes to non-conscious parts that are far more prehistoric. And so I would completely agree. And we, like you say, I think of that line from My Fair Lady, "Don't talk of love, show me." I mean, language only goes so far. So the nonverbal portion of our language is huge, by the way. We never gave that up. And it's the part we really trust the most. You can talk all day about something, but it's your actions that show it. And all of the things that you've been discussing, you know, this understanding of this biology and the sentient portion of you know, dog behavior and how similar we are, how mammalian we are. Let's drop that whole nonsense about superiority.
Yeah, well, I think
our pets consciously now.
I think we have illustrated that beautifully on the show, and I think it's a beautiful way to end about love. Don't tell me, show me.
That's right.
The voice you just heard was Meg Olmert. She's the author of Made for Each Other, The Biology of Human-Animal Bond. We also heard from Froma Walsh, co-director of the Chicago Center for Family Health and a professor emeritus at the University of Chicago. Like I said, we'll keep the discussion going in about 5 minutes at whyy.org/health and science. Next week, we're going to be talking about new research with autism. Excuse me. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons and Stephanie Marutis produce the show. Hannah Cope is our intern. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Tell me more.